July 12th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
Friendship Ebbs and Flows.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are back, episode 101. This is the 101 class, Pam, for translating into college level for you. This is episode 101 of Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. This is the Problem of Thor Bridge. Sounds very powerful, this bridge.
It's not the Rainbow Bridge, Steve. Thor Bridge.
Take
the Rainbow Bridge and the Asgard.
There is a Rainbow Bridge element to it, isn't there? Because there is a murder afoot here, isn't there?
There is certainly a problem at Thor Bridge. So it's interesting. The opening of this really seems very lighthearted, but this is a dark story, didn't you think?
Oh, yeah. Oof. Oh, yeah.
I was really excited. This whole story, this whole mystery was, I was riveted until the end. We'll get there. We'll get there, Pam.
We'll get there.
So will we talk about endings here?
Let's start at the beginning. So Watson is reviewing his notebooks. He mentions that there are some problems without solutions. And I am always so charmed when he gives us these like invitations to write fan fiction. Some, and not the least interesting, were complete failures, and as such will hardly bear narrating, since no final explanation is forthcoming. A problem without a solution may interest the student, but can hardly fail to annoy the casual reader.
You're right, Watson. When you write a story that has no solution, lost, it's annoying.
Wait, is he going J.J. Abrams on us?
Give me an ending, beginning, middle, and end. Doyle is right here.
It's postmodern. You, my friend, are enjoying sensibilities, my dear Steve. All right. Among these unfinished tales is that of Mr. James Fillmore, who, stepping back into his own house to get his umbrella, was never more seen in this world. No less remarkable is that of the cutter Alicia, which sailed one spring morning into a small patch of mist from where she never again emerged, nor was anything further ever heard of herself and her crew. A third case worthy of note is that of Isadora Persano, the well-known journalist and duelist, who was found stark staring mad with a matchbox in front of him, which contained a remarkable worm said to be unknown to science. Now, those are three very interesting stories, don't you think?
Okay, can I talk about the worm real quick? Because there is a series of remarkable worms in Doctor Who that do affect the minds of anyone who touches them. They erase the memory of the last few moments after you touch the worm. And yes, there are moments where people are found stark staring mad as a result of touching the worm. I think that's straight from Doyle here.
I was going to say, do you think it could be taken from this? It could be.
I never heard of such a thing until I watched Doctor Who, and now I see Doyle writing about it in 1902. No, this is 19.
This is
in 1922. I really think
earlier. Yeah. Ooh, interesting.
And I'm wondering if in Britain there's some version of the Bermuda Triangle type of tale.
I bet there is.
And then with this first one, you know, there's the missing people in the national parks. You can look it up on the internet. It's the latest conspiracy going around. How did they go missing? We don't know. Interesting. We don't know.
I do get into conspiracies like that. I do like my alien conspiracies from New Mexico, and I did travel there. I do like those stories. And yes, Doyle is really giving us an invitation to write some pastiches here.
Well, it's for the missing people in the national parks. There isn't an alien conspiracy. There is a lot of people who really just go missing in national parks. They don't know where they go. As in, we were walking together, and then we turned, and you were no longer there, and we don't find you.
And you don't suspect aliens? Chip.
Well, maybe you will go there. I'll go other places.
Or you could suspect Neil Gibson, the Gold King, from the story that we're discussing today.
Okay, here we go. Here we go. All right. Let's start with Neil Gibson, the Gold King. First of all, he bought a considerable estate in Hampshire some 5 years ago. Pam, you know this, right? I live in Hampshire.
Not this Hampshire, my friend.
The other Hampshire.
He's not the gold king here and where Steve lives. He's the corn king.
Corn king.
You know that I live in New London, Connecticut, which has a river called the Thames. So.
Oh, good for
I
us.
I don't
Thank
know.
Thank you, America. Thank you for making us more ignorant.
And I think it's so funny because Neil Gibson, he's formerly an American senator. So, you know, a major politician. But Holmes isn't very impressed. He's of some Western state. We don't even know which one. So, and he's very, very, he's obsessed with money and power, right?
Mm-hmm. Wait, wait, whoa, whoa. Are you telling me people in politics are concerned with money and power? Oh,
well,
my goodness.
He's not only Americans. In politics, he's a gold magnate. So, uh-huh. He is actually, so. He says, Gibson says, I can make or break, and it is usually break. It wasn't individuals only. It was communities, cities, even nations. Business is a hard game, and the weak go to the wall. I played the game for all it was worth. And that put forth as like an American value. Didn't you think the way that he was framed?
Uh-huh. This is absolutely American stereotypes of money and power obsession and in juxtaposition that with the British.
Is that the apology for British imperialism? I mean, come on.
Individualism. It's the individualism that we are currently having a problem with in America. The idea of the individual, I am going to make or break, even nations, is very American here.
Yes. And it's interesting because, so Sherlock tells Watson a little bit about Neil Gibson before he arrives. So what Sherlock says is this man is the greatest financial power in the world. And a man, as I understand, of most violent and formidable character. He married a wife, the victim of this tragedy, of whom I know nothing, save that she was past her prime, which was the most unfortunate, as a very attractive governess superintended the education of two young children. So when we learn of the case, that's what we know. This guy's married to someone who's, I mean, you guys know I love it when Doyle categorizes women's attractiveness by their age. I just think it's so cool. So this is a woman
past her prime.
Isn't that the most fascinating of statements, though? I mean, how old is past your prime? Just put it in your mind. You probably should verbalize that, Steve.
Well, the number has certainly changed as the lifespan has changed, right? But the idea of Hollywood and stars being past their prime after a certain age is something that we still battle today.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, this is very unfortunate that she's past her prime given this attractive young governess, right? So that's how Holmes introduces Watson and us. And then when we actually meet Neil Gibson, he gives us his perspective on this whole two women business. He says, well, to make a long story short, I loved her and I married her. It was only when the romance had passed and it lingered for years that I realized that we had nothing, absolutely nothing in common. My love faded. If hers had faded also, it might have been easier. But you know the wonderful way of women. Do what I might, nothing could turn her from me. If I have been harsh to her, even brutal, as some have said, it has been because I knew that if I could kill her love, or if it turned to hate, it would be easier for both of us. But nothing changed her. Now,
may I just say that is a trap of a conversation. We'll just let you just ponder on what he means by that. And I'll just sit here and never say a thing.
This is emotional torture. He fell out of love with his wife, and instead of saying something out loud to her about his feelings, he emotionally tortured her. If I've been harsh, even brutal, as some have said, which means he's had conversations with other people about his brutality. This is a dark, dark figure.
I will mention that in today's society, the ability to divorce certainly has liberated both of these people from situations that have to be like this. And he certainly, this could be certainly a commentary on his time, too.
Divorce is, possible at this time. So I think that's what he was going for. I mean, he wanted a divorce and she didn't, is how I'm reading this whole thing.
But he wanted her to initiate it because,
well, she has to agree to it. And especially, don't forget, he's like one of the wealthiest men in the world. So
right.
Getting a divorce is a little more complicated when you have that kind of wealth.
So. Wow. Jeff Bezos found a way, didn't he?
Yeah, 100 years
later. 100 years later, right? Yeah.
Sure.
Now, I'm just going to point out one other thing about this passage. And this is still true today, sadly, 100 years later. But how old do you think Neil Gibson is, you know, with this woman past her prime wife?
Oh.
Like, he married an older woman. He's the same or old, you know, he's the same age as her. Like, they're middle-aged couple. And you'll notice that at no point did Doyle say that this man is past his prime, because he's a guy, so he has no prime. There's no expiration date on his attractiveness. Like, it's just a disturbing comment. And when you made the comparison to Hollywood, that's still true in Hollywood today too, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Madonna's tours are always in Europe, right?
And David Hasselhoff is a big star in the Asian continent because of who he is over there. So there are examples of that where we have decided that somebody is quote-unquote past their prime. But yeah, it is much more likely for a female than for a male. Wow, that's... I don't like this story as much as I did 10 minutes ago.
No, it's great. No, I think the story is great, and the story really brings up a lot of super interesting issues about, like, gender representation, but also, like, really problematic gender dynamics. And I'm kind of intrigued by Watson's description of this guy. We're going around this guy, Neil Gibson. Watson says, if I were a sculptor and desired to idealize a successful man of affairs, iron of nerve and leathery of conscience, I love that, leathery of conscience, I should choose Mr. Neil Gibson as my model. His tall, gaunt, craggy figure had a suggestion of hunger and rapacity. And Abraham Lincoln, keyed to base uses instead of high ones, would give some idea of the man. His face might have been chiseled in granite, hard set, craggy, remorseless, with deep lines upon it, the scars of many a crisis. This is an older guy, right?
It's a beautiful description, though.
It really is to
conjure the idea of Abraham Lincoln's face,
yes,
which is pretty universal, even to the British apparently at this point. Yeah. That's really well written.
Well, if you've ever seen pictures of Abraham Lincoln before the Civil War, and then after the Civil War, you could just look at any president during that time, but certainly the amount of aging that happened during that time was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense. My goodness.
Well, right. And that's exactly what Doyle is saying. And speaking as a 65-year-old man here, he is saying, look at the scars of the crises upon my figure and the figures of these people. That's how it works.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We finally get to the case. We get to the details of the case, not just the character development, which is amazing.
So the wife was found in the grounds nearly half a mile from the house late at night. She was wearing her dinner dress with a shawl over her shoulders and a revolver bullet through her brain. Going to Holmes, no weapon was found near her and there was no local clue as to the murder. No weapon near her, Watson. Mark that. It's all very clear, but why suspect the governess? Well, in the first place, there is some very direct evidence. A revolver with one discharge chamber and a caliber which corresponded with the bullet was found on the floor of her wardrobe. His eyes fixed and he repeated in broken words, on the floor of her wardrobe. Then he sank into silence and I saw that some train of thought had been set moving, which I should be foolish to interrupt. And as the reader, we know, we're supposed to be thinking, wait, what's so important about the floor of her wardrobe? Watson, it was found. Pretty damning, eh? So the two juries thought. Then the dead woman had a note upon her making an appointment at that very place and signed by the governess. How's that? Finally, there's the motive. Senator Gibson is an attractive person. See that? He's actually an attractive person. If his wife dies, who more likely to succeed her than the young lady who had already, by all accounts, received pressing attentions from her employer? Love, fortune, power, all depending upon one middle-aged life. Ugly, Watson. very ugly. And that's mm-hmm. where I'm like, one middle-aged life or two, buddy? the only middle-aged person here is this woman past her prime, which is completely untrue, of course.
This is where I was really excited by this whole mystery, where Holmes goes into his almost trance-like state, yes. and then abruptly comes out of it and says, I've discovered something in my thinking process. This is something that we've seen from Sherlock many times before, but it's never really happened in real time like this. This is one of three times in this story where Sherlock kind of goes comatose to think this idea through. I love that.
Was this ultimately adopted by people in that era where, you know, I want to be Sherlock-like, I can sit down and deep think this thing through and then come out with my solution?
I think there's plenty of people that do that. I think there's plenty of people that usually go away from the situation to go think it through, but sometimes just stopping in the middle of what you're doing, thinking through your ideas, and then coming back to the situation. I do that.
Oh, I mean, I think many of us do, but go into a trance-like situation and very quickly go, now I've got the answer. Or I've got at least the plausible beginning of an answer.
I think I see in detective fiction. I think it's one of the one of the tropes that comes from Holmes, for sure.
Sure. Yeah. All right.
We find out about Mr. Gibson's household when Mr. Marlowe Bates shows up at the rooms of Holmes and Watson, and Billy opens the door. Hey, look, everyone. It's Billy. He's still there.
And everyone's surprised because they were expecting Mr. Neil Gibson, and instead they get one of his servants, and he looks super nervous, Bates, and he says, okay, I just need to tell you a few things. Neil Gibson's on his way, but let me just give you some info. She, the late Mrs. Gibson, she had loved him as such women can love, but when her own physical charms had faded, I am told they once were great, there was nothing to hold him. We all liked her and felt for her and hated him for the way that he treated her, but he is plausible and cunning. That is all I have to say to you. Don't take him at his face value. There is more behind. And then, of course, as soon as someone says, that's all I'm going to say on this matter, they always tell you just a little bit more, including here, Mr. Gibson has his enemies, as anyone would expect who knew him and his methods. He sleeps with a loaded revolver in the drawer beside his bed. He is a man of violence, sir, and there are times when all of us are afraid of him. I am sure that the poor lady who has passed was often terrified. So that is pretty damning information mm-hmm. from the household of Mr. Gibson.
But for Steve, I have spoken is how we would end that part, right?
Well, he not only says, I have spoken, but he literally gets up and runs out the door.
Exactly.
He is so nervous to be there. He thinks that this is so important that he has to share this information with these investigators who are investigating this case. But he is so nervous, he is almost going to pass out. Watson says that he was very afraid for this man's health because that's how scared he is of this situation.
Well, in today's society, with a person as wealthy as this gentleman, you know, obviously there would be some kind of non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah, that's keeping secrets helps powerful people to be more powerful. Great.
Well, why would they want, you know, whatever dirty laundry they have to get out into the public, Steve?
Mm-hmm. It's easier not to have dirty laundry.
But when there's a murder investigation, my friends, the public does find out things. Now, after we meet Neil Gibson from a few different perspectives, we hear about the two women who are involved in a little more detail. And I think it's interesting. So Mrs. Gibson, she is another one of these women. We've seen plenty of them throughout the canon. She's exoticized, right? She's a Brazilian beauty. And she has that passion of the non-English woman. So very much in contrast to the very lovely British Miss Grace Dunbar. So
reserved.
Exactly. Mr. Bates says about Mrs. Gibson, she was a creature of the tropics, a Brazilian by birth, as no doubt you know. No, it had escaped me, said Holmes. Tropical by birth and tropical by nature, right? So we've got that idea of passion. And then Neil Gibson says, I could see that she was rare and wonderful in her beauty, It was a deep, rich nature too. Passionate, wholehearted, tropical, ill-balanced, very different from the American women I had known. So once again, we get that notion. You'll notice he uses some of the same words, right? Passionate, wholehearted, tropical, but he adds to it ill-balanced. And so there is a sense. And this is, you know, Jane Eyre is the wonderful, wonderful Victorian example of a British story that has a South American woman in it. We don't have to go into Bertha Mason right now, but who kind of represents this exotic other by which Western women, usually British women, but sometimes American as well, are characterized. So
I've seen those carnival parades. I know what's going on down there.
Miss Grace Dunbar is really, truly beautiful. When they finally meet her, Watson says, "I had expected from all that we had heard to see a beautiful woman, but I can never forget the effect which Miss Dunbar produced upon me. It was no wonder that even the masterful millionaire had found in her something more powerful than himself, something which could control and guide him." Wow, Watson. She is that stunning a beauty. Wow.
Well, he's had women on three continents, Steve.
Is this just shorthand for she's young?
No, because
young and beautiful
and powerful. Because look at, I'm reading from where you left off, Steve. One felt too, as one looked at the strong, clear-cut and yet sensitive face, that even should she be capable of some impetuous deed, nonetheless, there was an innate nobility of character which would make her influence always for the good. And Neil Gibson tells them that she had totally influenced him. And he had said, you know, "I can make or break communities, not just individuals, even communities and nations." And he says, she saw it different. I guess she was right. She believed and said that a fortune for one man that was more than he needed should not be built on 10,000 ruined men who were left without the means of life. So she's some sort of like social activist who's influencing this self-made millionaire who has a ton of inequity in his labor practices, I think we could say.
So this is shorthand for saying before he met her that he did not put money at NPR for the news. So
he's
made, well, it doesn't necessarily be a Scrooge. It may not be top of mind. She is, in many ways, has tamed him. He may have had other goals. It wasn't necessarily being a Scrooge. He may have not been aware that he could do these other things and have an impact elsewhere. She certainly has a very positive influence on his other parts of his lives that may have been ignored before him.
AKA, she's a teacher. Thank you.
Now, I'm going to go a little deeper into that, though, if you guys don't mind. Because I think
I don't mind.
Like, the social and gender dynamic here is fascinating. Didn't you guys think, like, there's a lot to be plumbed from this? Because it's Gibson who says, look, she was such a good influence on me. She was such a pretty, young, British, reserved woman. And she made me see the error of my ways. So he's like, he's picking up this narrative, right? That he is a changed man. She has transformed him. And what does he do with that? Like, that's why he's cruel to his wife. I don't know. Are you guys cool with that?
Oh, that certainly is a very interesting. And I don't fall for traps like that, Pam. That is a trap that guys will not talk about.
No,
that's crazy. That is certainly poor form. And certainly not...
He is emotionally torturing her. He is driving her away in a hurtful way that ends very darkly.
And now I want to go to a passage where Gibson and Holmes talk this out a little bit. It's interesting that although Watson has been giving us lots of commentary on the side, it's Holmes who really takes Gibson to task and I think does a really like modern day gender analysis here. Gibson says, "Now, I make no pretense to be more moral than my neighbors," which I think is good because no one's going to buy that you're more moral than your neighbors. "And I will admit to you that I could not live under the same roof with such a woman and in daily contact with her without feeling a passionate regard for her. Do you blame me, Mr. Holmes? I do not blame you for feeling it. I should blame you if you expressed it. Since this young lady was, in a sense, under your protection, she's the governess of your kids, okay? So she is your live-in nanny, the teacher of your children. So Holmes is really laying it down here. You may never tell her how you feel. Well, maybe so, said the millionaire, though for a moment, the reproof had brought the old angry gleam to his eyes. I'm not pretending to be any better than I am. I guess all my life, I've been a man that reached out his hand for what he wanted, and I never wanted anything more than the love and possession of that woman. I told her so. Oh, you did you? Holmes could look very formidable when he was moved. So Holmes is saying, look, for you to verbally come on to this woman who's living in your home, who's the young teacher of your children, while your wife, past her prime or not, is in the household, is completely inappropriate. And he is calling down like a very strong, firm, formidable notion of British mores that is not acceptable. Mm-hmm. And he goes on and says, it is only for the young lady's sake that I touch your case at all, said Holmes sternly. I don't know that anything she is accused of is really worse than what you have yourself admitted, that you have tried to ruin a defenseless girl who was under your roof. Some of you rich men have to be taught that all the world cannot be bribed into condoning your offenses. This is like a Me Too movement time. Like, this really, this is powerful analysis from Sherlock that, I mean, we've seen hints that Sherlock and Watson are really committed to the defense of like damsels in distress of all kinds. But this is Sherlock saying, like, this is a systemic issue. Rich men like you are not allowed to take for granted the young, attractive women who work in their households. And that's why I'm taking this case. The fact that she's accused of murder, that's actually not worse than what you did to her. I feel very excited that this 1920s novel with a character that I totally adore is really like addressing a super important issue that 100 years later, we're still addressing all and, you know, in much the same terms.
And absolutely, he is taking this stance. Absolutely, he is putting this down on paper and publishing this as a thought that he apparently thinks is very important for the time. And yes, it is. This is such a dark story about torture, about the mental anguish between this family that this should be taught more often, Pam. You should teach this one. This is a good one.
And it's a story of a rich, powerful man who thinks he can do anything he wants.
And what is also interesting about it, as I looked up the where it was originally published, it was for the Strand magazine, which is a United Kingdom magazine. And I was wondering if it was being written for the American audience because of using the American senator as our example. Because mistresses or whatever affairs certainly have a the American experience is certainly much more prudish than many times over in Europe concerning that situation.
Although I would just note that all of Doyle's all of the Sherlock Holmes stories were published at within a month of each other in both the US and the UK. So it was 100% intended for both audiences.
Okay.
A little bit of Holmes's methods here. Not too much. I mean, it's. I think the focus of the story is very much on this really dark triangle. Three times, as you mentioned earlier, Steve, Sherlock does go into an almost trance-like state. In one of those moments, I thought it was kind of funny. He's on the train with Watson. He could not sit still, but paced the carriage or drummed with his long, sensitive fingers upon the cushions behind him. Suddenly, however, as we neared our destination, he seated himself opposite to me. We had a first-class carriage to ourselves, and laying a hand upon each of my knees, he looked into my eyes with the peculiarly mischievous gaze which was characteristic of his more imp-like moods. Watson, said he, I have some recollection that you go armed upon these excursions of ours. So basically, he asks for the gun.
And of course, we think that he thinks there's going to be danger and he needs to be armed, but that is not where Doyle is taking us this time.
Exactly. He wants Watson's revolver to do a bit of an experiment.
Nothing like using handguns for experiments. I mean, what could go wrong?
Well, where there's a handgun, where the mystery involves a shooting, there's certainly some ballistics that need to be taken up here, and this is the most unusual ballistics ever. But it works out. He finds the solution, a shocking and dark solution here. He takes Watson's gun, ties it to a rock over the edge of Thor Bridge. At the words, he raised the pistol to his head and then let go his grip. In an instant, it had been whisked away by the weight of the stone, had struck with a sharp crack against the parapet, and had vanished over the side into the water. It had hardly gone before Holmes was kneeling beside the stonework, and a joyous cry showed that he had found what he expected.
So that's where we get the solution. And you guys, like, we only ever knew four people, counting Mr. Bates, and I never really suspected him. So who could have done this? Was it Neil Gibson? Was it Miss Dunbar? The only other person we know is Mrs. Gibson. And it was her. And
this is
so sad, right? This is a suicide that's meant to create, I mean, not only the pain that suicide always creates,
but meant to frame Miss Dunbar.
Sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. To cause even more pain after the pain of this, who knows how long, months, maybe years of emotional damage.
Sure.
She's trying to cause even more damage in her taking of her own life. Wow, this is dark.
This is. And I actually find the ending rather dark as well. So after this really disturbing solution, at the very end, Sherlock says, "Well, Watson, because we have helped a remarkable woman, because they have proved that she is not, in fact, the killer, and also a formidable man. Should they in the future join forces, as seems not unlikely, the financial world may find that Mr. Neil Gibson has learned something in that schoolroom of sorrow where our earthly lessons are taught." I don't know, guys. Do you think that Mr. Neil Gibson is a transformed man now that his wife has committed suicide and attempted to implicate his mistress, possibly to be wife?
Well, the American ending is it was a happy ending and everything was perfect afterwards.
Because the two of them were meant to be together and they got the wife out of the way. Oh, oh.
But this was British, and that's not the ending. It's dark. Oof. It's very dark.
All right. So did we learn? Did Doyle learn anything in this? He's trying to make a statement about these things, and this ending really goes to not learning, because the idea of these two people joining forces, the financial world may find that Mr. Neil Gibson has learned something. Oh, boy. I don't know what Doyle's trying to say with his last sentence, Pam.
Well, I mean, I think that Sherlock takes at face value what Neil Gibson said, which is that Miss Dunbar does have a good influence on his business practices, that it has made him more open to the idea that you don't have to ruin everyone in order to win. And so, I mean, I think Holmes is trying to find, Holmes seems like he's feeling the way we are, like, this is really sad. Mm. And in fact, you know, there's no crime has been committed. It's a suicide. And so he's trying to imagine, like, maybe something good will come out of this, because probably Neil Gibson will probably marry the young governess. And hopefully she will actually be the good influence on him that he has claimed she is.
Okay.
It's a, you know.
Now I feel better. Thank you, Pam. Thank you for making me feel better about this. I really enjoyed this mystery from the beginning up until that really dark ending. I was even able to go past the mental torture of it when it was described in the beginning, if there was a conclusion that was something other than suicide. Suicide is awful for everybody involved. The idea of MASH suicide is painless is not valid. There's so much pain that goes along with it. And boy, I hope that something good comes from these fictional characters that don't exist.
But they do in a way, you know it.
So I'm the person who didn't like the story. I thought the story dragged and was very slow. I'm very glad that you guys did, because it certainly made for a much better conversation than what I was coming, where I was coming from. But yeah, this was interesting.
So why didn't you like it, Chip?
Yeah, I kept waiting for it. Like, come on, what's going on? And it could have been how I read it. And I used an Audible version of, or an audio version with Christopher Lee, and I was reading along with it. But I felt just dragged, and I just kept waiting for it to keep moving forward. And, you know, we got all the beats of it. We got the beats of this story, but it certainly was not my flavor of the month.
Okay.
I wonder how much of that is what we bring to a story. How much of that is your mindset when you sat down to read this versus my mindset when I sat down to read it?
Total reflection on me. We should go ahead and analyze that.
No, that's something we talk about in literature analysis all the time, Chip, is the author wrote down these words, but they're not his anymore. Once they are on paper, we bring so much to it, and what your day brought to you might have changed how you looked at this story, for sure.
Exactly.
Good.
So readers are active participants in the stories.
Yeah.
And how they are received.
So it's... proud of you, Chip.
Thank you. I'm growing. One day I may actually have a heart. You know? I won't be the Grinch anymore.
But I do think that especially stories that tackle really difficult topics like this, like topics like suicide, which I have to say, as a professor, I always have to really debate, like, am I going to teach a story that has a suicide in it? That can be a really triggering issue for a lot of students. And, you know, it also can open up really, really important conversations, very complex conversations. And so I do think, I mean, any story, of course, the reader brings what we bring, but a story that deals with something this difficult is obviously going to have that much more of an impact. I think it's interesting that in the casebook, you know, the Sussex vampire was set up as sort of like a fun story with like the funny, you know, business letters from the beginning and the end, whatever. That was a very dark story of difficult family dynamics as well. And so I'm kind of, you know, the casebook of Sherlock Holmes is certainly the least beloved of the short story collections, and we can see why. But there's a lot of depth in these late stories. Doyle is really addressing a lot of very complicated, deep psychological issues and questions of the early 20th century.
He's a mature writer who's not phoning it in. He certainly is trying to address what he feels are the topics of his time.
Yep.
And he's done a very good job at that part. And, you know, it's probably not as beloved because the beats of the earlier stuff are just, they're a little more juvenile.
Right.
True.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah, and Chip, I take your point that this was not a fast-paced story. Agree. And there weren't a lot of funny bits at all.
No.
We've come to really enjoy the humor of, I mean, there weren't even any points where Sherlock was like, Watson, surely you see something. And Watson's like, I don't see a thing.
Nope.
Like, we didn't even have a single such moment. So
but we did have Holmes grabbing Watson's knees. So we got that going for us.
But it's just a faint echo of when Watson saw Holmes's heart in the previous story. All right, we should wrap.
Right.
Woo! Once we hit
another one of the shows where we're going to go longer than the actual audio.
Exactly.
Huh?
Forgive us.
Good. I hope everybody's enjoying this. I hope that everybody is seeking the help that they need. When you need help, please reach out, call somebody, talk to somebody. Please understand that talking it out is scary, but talking it out is probably the best thing you can do. Find the help that you need. I hope everybody out there is doing okay. We would love to hear from you. We would love to hear your voice. Send us a voicemail. Send us an email. And follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for the conversations about all these great stories that we've been reading, along with all the other stories that we've been reading that have not been as great. You can go to our dedicated Holmes website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, for all 101 episodes of this fun show where we've got some great conversations. Join us tomorrow for the adventure of the Creeping Man. Horror, probably, right? There's a horror episode. Is it the Monster of the Week episode? We'll find out. I don't know. Maybe. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.